And the preaching we may need, some of us right now, is to realize that if the table is to be bigger, it can't just be to the center and left of us. It has to be to the right of us somehow. And we're going to talk about the problems of that. But I want to pause here, and I want to see if we have microphones to pass, Todd. Thank you. We're going to pass microphones, and I want you to, we do this thing in our church called What Are You Thinking? It's a very profound idea. I ask you what you're thinking. And I want you to hear, I want you to tell us what you're frustrated with, what you're hearing tonight that's encouraging, what's challenging you. Share anything you'd like. So put up your hand, and they will get the microphone to you, and we'll have some fun.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
What I'm thinking right now is I'm pondering what you just said about how do you make the table larger for people whose opinion is to exclude is the way to do things. And I struggle with that myself, and that's just what I'm thinking.
Yes, and the thing is, it was really easy for me. I'm really good at holding up the life and ministry of Jesus to evangelicals as a mirror and say, look at Jesus and look at yourself. Do these things resemble one another? And I could really be convincing in that. And it was a lot easier for me now, a lot easier for me then to say, love your enemies, before I realized how close my enemies were, how loud, how prevalent they were. It was much easier to tell people to love their enemies before I realized how much loving I was going to be required to do, right? So we all have to figure out that balance between keeping relationships open, keeping those lines of communication there, and not ratifying things that are destructive or damaging, right? So diversity for me has changed now. Diversity doesn't mean you can come together and just say anything you want to anyone. Diversity means that people are all, their inherent worth is welcomed, and that often means erring on the side of marginalized people, right? Because I would much rather err on the side of marginalized people right now and alienate people from me who don't understand that diversity is beautiful. So I'd never want to sacrifice marginalized people on the altar of my diversity. I want to lean into that. So that's going to be a challenge for all of us. Yes.
John, could you, after the question, could you repeat it from your mic
so
the folks in the other room can
Yes.
hear?
Hi, John. I just want to say you're amazing.
Thank you.
And you're a gift from God to this world. The other thing is, I am one of the ones that's always been loud and been an outcast my whole life.
Mm.
I'm very different. I have different hair. I'm gay. And what I have been thinking, I listen to a lot Bishop Pearson. I'm sure you know who Carlton is.
Sure.
And I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But why have we been taught our whole lives as Christians and as humans we need to be fixed?
Mm.
God said we were made good in the beginning.
Yeah.
When did we decide we need to be fixed? Why are we broken and not in the image of God that he called us to be and spoke us into existence?
Yeah. Well, the problem is...
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is on how we've gotten an image of God who no longer sees us as good. How did we become people who are broken? I think fear is... we're all default to fear. If there isn't evidence to the contrary or there aren't voices to help us, we're going to default to the places of fear. And religious people have bought into this idea of fear because it can be so easily leveraged. You know, and the people that we tend to be frustrated by right now, the people whose theology feels toxic to us, they have an image of God who is angry and always out to squash them. And so part of it is understanding that if you feel that that's the nature of God, you are going to act in those ways because you want to save yourself from that God, right? We can see that as, how terrible is that, right? But I remember, tell the story in the book of being in a hotel coffee shop talking to this lesbian woman about the bigger table. And again, talking to her, thinking in my head, I'm being very convincing and sounding wise. And she said, John, I want you to look out there. And she pointed out the window. And outside the window was Southern Baptist sign guy. And she said, how do I love him and welcome him to my table? And I wanted to phone a friend. Right? Because I realized I was asking a lot of her. But I looked at Southern Baptist sign guy with the horrible things on his sign and the bullhorn and the scowl on his face. And I said, we look at sign guy and we understand two things. He didn't come out of the womb as sign guy. Can you imagine the trauma for mom, right? But he didn't come out like that. And he has a story that led him there. And right now, sign guy holding that sign in his head thinks, I'm trying to do what God wants me to do. I said, right now he's doing exactly what you and I are doing. He's trying to hear the voice of God and respond in faith. And even though we see him as dangerous and damaging and all these things, he doesn't know that. So as we look at hateful religion and people who have a faith that's very exclusionary, think about the fact that they don't understand that that is so. Everyone thinks they're getting it right. Everyone thinks they have the right cause. So part of it is learning to have mercy on people who don't understand that love is the better path. Yes, down in front here. Put up your hand high so the microphone holders can see them. That would be great. Thank you.
So I think my biggest problem, I guess, is that people are getting reinforced in their beliefs in their toxic churches, yes, but they're also getting reinforced in these toxic beliefs in everywhere else they go, in the places they hang out, in social media,
sure,
the news they watch, the websites they visit and everything. You know, the only solution, I guess, that I've heard to this is to approach people one person to one person. But I don't know how we're going to overcome this, you know, I'll use the word, but the fake media problem, I
right.
guess.
Well, right now, the only thing that I tell people who are doing the work of love and compassion and mercy and justice and equality is the other people who are running, who are perpetuating a faith that is the opposite of that, they're really loud. People are really loud about walls and borders and all those things. And so people like yourselves have to become louder and something worth being loud about, right? It's not, I think progressive Christians or people who just love humanity have to stop apologizing for their views and actually let other people hear them. Because when you let other people hear you, it may not change the person you're talking to, but it's going to change a lot of things. I'll get to something about that in a second, but I want to hear some of your questions.
I wish my problem was that I need to expand the table to listen or invite those to the right of me. But I think maybe more my problem is that I'm not willing to be truly authentic. I'm the partial authentic.
Okay.
So that they will want to come to my table because I'm afraid if I am truly authentic to what I believe, they won't want to come.
Okay, so your dilemma is, for those in the other room, is that you the other people who you would invite, you can't really invite because you can't really be fully authentic right now, and you can't let them know just who you are and what you believe. And honestly, that's huge for us, right? Because saying what you believe, being authentic yourselves now is going to place you into turbulence. It's going to bring conflict, and nobody wants that. Life is busy and life is difficult, as we said. And the hardest thing is to say, oh, I'm going to say this so I can blow up these relationships that mean so much to me. I got a gift. I was fired, right? I wish for people to be fired and to have these things, because then the bottom drops out and you're left with, I have no other choice but to be authentic. But for all of us, there is a price to speaking your truest truth. And what I want to say to you is, after the election, I said to a group of the people in our church, I said to the white people in our church, I know wading into these waters is difficult, but if you are waiting for the moment when the needs of oppressed people outweigh your inconvenience and saying something on their behalf, that time has come and gone. So now it's about you taking some of the difficulties on your shoulders, because some people live with urgency because they have to, right? So maybe for us, it's time to embrace that. Maybe it's time to take on some of the bruises and the battering of other people. A couple more.
I couldn't refuse your invitation, Todd. Speaking to much of what has just been said, this morning I was in a small group, a ladies' group at another church, not a Presbyterian church, and we talked about the language of the environment. Where you are often determines how and what you say. Mm. And there has to be a certain level of trust before you can be open. And what I find is that we are often segregated into a particular environment, and we know how to act and speak in that environment. And then if we go into for example, a cocktail party, we're not going to be talking about spiritual things, whereas in this environment, I can discuss spiritual things.
Sure. Yeah, so, well, and I go to weird cocktail parties because that's what we talk about at my cocktail parties. What do you feel happens after you die? You know, it brings people down. Part of it is, I think, learning to just have conversations. You know those people who say, well, we don't talk about religion and politics, right? And I tell them, there's not a whole lot left of substance, right? Because for Jesus, everything was spiritual. It wasn't like my political life and there's this. There was my politics is my faith, because my faith is the lens through which I view everything, the environment and marriage and the economy and all these things. So part of it is realizing there is no division between spiritual things and non-spiritual things, and spiritual environments and non-spiritual environments. We just have to learn to be a little bit more willing to say, well, God doesn't have to wait in the car while I'm at a cocktail party or at the movies or with my friends. So I try to find ways to bring meaningful, it doesn't have to be religious, it just can be meaningful. And I love to have people around me who want to ask tough questions, but it is hard. A lot of us have socialized where we go, oh, these people can't hear about my church stuff because they're gonna think I'm crazy. Well, show them you're crazy. Let them see it. Yes. Any others?
Okay.
Yes, sir.
It seems like we're in kind of a hysterical time.
Mm-hmm.
People are unwilling to think about things. They're just they've got their minds made up and everything. So my question is this, and this is not a segue into your new book. My question is this: coming from where you're coming from, what you've seen, the people that you've met, what kind of hope do we have that, building the tables, expanding the table, are you seeing any kind of progress from that kind of thing? Do we have any hope, I guess is my question.
The question for the people in the room is, given all that I've seen and all that I'm experiencing and all that I've been talking about, you know, do I have hope? No. Good night. Drive safely. Let me talk about that for a bit. Let's hold the questions for a couple minutes. I want to share some things with you that I feel like is important. So as you get older, you learn things change about your body, right? It's about to get real up in here. No. I realize now that my body at this age is no longer capable of being upside down. So I used to be able to do a somersault off a diving board. I cannot do that any longer. The paramedics will have to be called, right? I used to be able to do a somersault. I can't do that. I used to love roller coasters that made me go upside down, but I can't ride them anymore. Bad things happen. You know, I start to get really ill, but what happens is I get to an amusement park now, and I begin to try and I forget. Like, we were at Disney a couple weeks ago, I'm with the family, and we're looking up at this roller coaster, and everyone seems to be having such fun. And so I begin to talk to myself, and I'm thinking, that looks fun. Look at that little girl riding that. I can do that. And it's such a great day, and I mean, I've written a book, I can ride that roller coaster. I get in, and they strap me in, and the thing takes off, and within 10 seconds, my brain says, I thought we talked about this. It says, You know how this is going to end. It is not going to end well, and you didn't listen, and now you're going to pay. Well, I can no longer be upside down, and I feel profoundly upside down right now, to your question. I think you know what it feels like to be inverted, right? To feel that disorientation. I think you experience it. I experienced on the night of the election. I've experienced on the day of the inauguration. I experience it watching, you know, Nazis marching through streets. I see it with Muslim bands. I see it every day. I feel that upside downness of it all. And I think you know those feelings, right? I think you know the disorientation, the fractures you feel in relationships that used to feel so strong. I know you walk away from conversations with people you used to rely on for compassion and wisdom, and now you no longer recognize those things in them. I think you've seen pastors post things and neighbors say things, and I think it's all left you feeling really isolated. And I think you ask a question 100 times a day, is it me or is a huge portion of this country lost its mind? It isn't you. That is both the good and the horrifying news. It's good news because of what it says about you, and it's bad news because of what it says about the place and time where you are alive here in America. But the fact that you see how upside down it all is, the fact that you see how horrible it is, means your faculties are intact. It means your mind is fully right. It means your heart is working properly. It means your soul is still doing what a soul is supposed to do, keep you profoundly humane in humane times. So all this disorientation you're feeling, all the upside downness, I want you to celebrate it. Because if you believe in God, that's the heart of God. Or you simply believe in goodness, that's where goodness lives. It lives in your anxiety and your outrage and your grief. People ask me all the time, when I say people, why are you here? Often people say, I'm here because I've lost hope. Or I'm losing hope. Or I want to be around people of hope. And they use that word. That's what got me thinking about writing about hope all the time. And I think what a gift that hope is, because what hope is hope is something aspirational, right? It's that hope is that thing that propels us into days that we don't want to walk into. Hope says, if I keep doing something good now in the present, someday it's going to bear beautiful fruit, right? And so hope is something essential that we cannot afford to lose, right? I want to, Judith, you can sit down for a second. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to leave you standing. I want to tell you a story. I wasn't sure I was going to tell you this story, but I'm going to tell you because Tulsa, we're close now. The election was approaching in 2016. Thanks, Todd. The election was approaching, and if my wife were here, she would tell you that I am a pessimist. I don't like that term. I find it offensive. I like to say that I'm prepared for the worst case scenario. Like, I want to know how bad things can go so that I'm practically and emotionally prepared when the bottom drops out and it all hits the fan. So that will often, being a preparer of the worst case scenario, will often cause me to act as if the worst case scenario is an inevitability. Now that is not fun to live with. And so the election was coming and I remembered I did what I do. I prophesied disaster. And my wife Jen, who is a pessimist and an optimist, said, honey, listen, here are the poll numbers. Here's all the data. She was trying to talk me down off the ledge. I said, I love you. I found a comfy spot on the ledge, and this is where I'm staying. Because what happened was the day of the election came, and I said, I got a plan. My plan is that I'm going to vote, and I'm coming home tonight, and at 8 p.m., I'm taking half an Ambien and going to bed. And I said, you have my permission to wake me up if we get good news. I voted, came home, took an Ambien at 8 p.m., went to bed. The next thing I knew, I rolled over and saw the clock. It said 11:30. I said, no. I took the other half of the Ambien. But as Tuesday turned into Wednesday, and the reality hit, it began for myself and for my family what was a time of profound grieving. Not figurative, not just kind of theoretical, but a real loss at what felt like a death. We grieve things that night that were big and distant and things that were small and close, right? We grieve the death of things. It wasn't about a man. It wasn't about one person. It's never been about one person, right? It was what was uncovered in that moment for us. It was the things we learned about the bigotry and racism and homophobia of our country that we thought was gone. It was the myth of our shared coexistence that died. It was the death of the idea of church or country or family that we had. And we grieved that, and we still do, but we grieve things that were small and close too. We grieved the stuff we learned about our neighbors. We grieved the words we heard from coworkers, social media posts from friends. Everything felt tainted, didn't it? And nothing is untouched by this grief. And here's the problem, friends. When someone you love dies, they die once, and you process that grief. But right now, we experience death every day. Whenever there's a piece of legislation, or ever there's an act of hatred, or whenever there's a tweet tantrum, right? Those things, they cause us to grieve again and again, and we can never get rest. And I know that you're here tonight and you're exhausted, and I know that you're sad, and I know that you're grieving. And to your question, this has all been worse than even my worst case scenario. The sort of hatred that's been bubbling up and all of the cruelty, it's been more than even an Olympic-level pessimist like myself was prepared for. And yet, I want you to hear this tonight because it's the truth. Despite everything, despite how stomach-turning it's been, and despite all the sleep I've lost and all the grieving I've done and all the worry lines I've acquired and all the wine I've consumed and all the expletives I've spoken, despite all those things, I do have hope today. Because I want you to think about what you have seen since this season in our lives began. I've seen thousands, millions of people become overnight activists. I've seen people engaging in the political process. I've seen people running for office who would never do it before. I've seen people leveraging their social media profiles to speak words of affirmation and truth and love. I've been at pride parades when groups of moms showed up to give hugs to people in the name of parents who would not hug them, right? I've seen people go to airports and stand with refugee families. I've seen Muslim bans fail and healthcare repeals fall. And I've seen people stand time and time again. I've seen them in progressive faith communities and humanist conferences and interfaith services and Muslim gatherings. And I've seen people over and over repeat the same thing. We will not be people of exclusion and hatred and love and hatred. We will speak love loudly in this world. You've seen it, right? And I want you to realize something. You've seen the best of yourselves in this last 2 years, probably. You've found passions you didn't know you had. You've found a voice that you had never used. These are things worth celebrating. This is where the hope lives. So it's upside down, yes, but we can right side it. And the way we do this is we begin to live lives of personal activism. I want you to think about this before you leave tonight. I'm not talking about work with nonprofits or faith communities or civic organizations. I'm going to assume you're doing that. This is the life that you live, the individual story that you live, and what kind of personal activism are you going to live out? In other words, you don't have to be a jerk blogger. That job is taken. Stay out of my territory. Right? But there is an activism. People often think activism is simply standing in a street with signs yelling at people across the street with different signs. But activism is so much more subtle and diverse than that. It's so much more expansive. And you can find a sense of activism, a lifestyle of activism that reflects your beliefs and your personality, right? I want to give you a couple things that you can think about as activism that you probably don't think about lately. Do you know that family conversations have become more difficult? Yes. No? No, good. Just me. You know, you get those conversations where you're at a family gathering and it begins to go political again and you think, okay, stepping backwards, and you leave. I call it the dip out. We talked about it last night. The dip out is I just leave and no one knows that I've left. They go, where's John? I think he's in the bathroom. No, he's in the other living room. No, John dipped out an hour ago. You know, you get in those conversations where you begin to withdraw. Maybe your personal activism right now is that now you're going to take a step into those conversations one more time. Because maybe the people who are going to be there are going to be ready to hear what you say this time. Or maybe they're going to you're going to find the right words that reach them. Or maybe they're just going to be ready to receive you. And that's important. So I want you to use those difficult conversations and not always back away anymore. Step into them and speak more clearly than you ever have. Another way you can be a personal activist is, I don't know, they have social media in Tulsa, right? You have the internet here? Good. I wasn't sure. How many people in this room have at least one social media account? Put your hands up in the air. Great. The rest of you, get on social media. It's important. Think about the gift that you have. You have hundreds, maybe thousands of people that you can reach with whatever message you have. Cats are nice. Dog puppy pictures are nice. Pictures of your grandkids are great. All these things. But maybe you need to use that social media account to perpetuate some acts of justice and beauty in the world. And I want to tell you why this is important. I met an 80-year-old woman in Missouri not long ago, and we were doing the Q&A, and she said, I have a great story for you, John. And I said, I love great stories. And she said, I have a good friend, and she started sharing a meme that said really horrible things about people of color. And so I posted on her social media account why I thought this was terrible, and she unfriended me. So that's a terrible story, lady. I don't know why you're telling me that. But she said, I share that story because right before my friend unfriended me, I got a friend request from someone else, our mutual friend. And I accepted it, and the woman wrote to me and said, I've been feeling completely alone on my faith journey. I have a feeling like there's no one around me who believes what I believe and cares about what I care about. And she said, seeing your words to our mutual friend gave me hope to keep going today, and I want to say thank you. This is what I want you to realize. You're not just speaking to the person you're speaking to. You're speaking to a multitude who is looking on and looking for reason to believe there are good people still left here. So use that social media account. Now, it may go horribly wrong. If it does, I'll email me. I'll send you a t-shirt, right? And if talking to your relatives and having those hard conversations, that may go horribly wrong too, so I'll send you 2 t-shirts. But I want you, so that's just some ways that you can do some personal activism. Another, this is gonna sound so simple. One is hearing stories that you're not hearing. There are people right now who either because you're not around them or because you've written them off, you think you know their story. The whole reason I started this journey was because I realized I had false stories. So maybe you need to make invitations, actually set a table, and begin hearing those stories, because those stories are going to change you, right? Because you can't, when you hear someone's story and you sit across from them at a meal, you can't caricaturize them. You can't make them into a cartoon. You can't make them into a stereotype. So keep hearing stories. But the last thing I want you to think about in your personal activism is, it sounds so trite, sharing your story and using your voice. Why is this important? Because you spent your whole life with your story and your voice, and you're blind and deaf to how powerful it is and how meaningful it is. If you knew what your story could do in other people's lives, you would never stop sharing it, right? I was fired from my job, right? And I remember I wrote this blog post called If I Have Gay Children. And I'd written it because I wanted to personalize something that Christians often don't personalize. I wanted to humanize something they often dehumanize. And I remember writing the blog post, and I showed it to my wife. I showed it to Jen before I published it, which was strange for her because usually I publish things and let her clean up the mess later. Like, oh no, you wrote that? But I showed it to her, and she said, oh, it's beautiful, but why are you showing it to me? And I realized I was still feeling as a pastor that I could get in trouble. And she said, well, they can't fire you twice. Thank you. Thank you, honey. But here's what happened. I published that piece, and later that afternoon, 750,000 people had read it. And then 1.5 million people. And it kept going and going and going. And the next day, I'm on CNN. Here I am on CNN talking, and underneath me, or in front of me, it says, John Pavlovitz, pastor. And it might as well have said, also unemployed and currently despondent. Right? Looking for work. Here's why that's important. Because when I published those words, I had no financial capital, I had no marketing campaign, I had no mechanism to artificially inflate that. I had my words written from the deepest place, and I put them out into the world, and those words did work that brought us together tonight. So How dare you not think that there's power and beauty in your story and your voice? You have to be bolder in using them. Maybe that's your greatest source of personal activism, is simply speaking. I want to just share one more thing. I thank you for your patience and your presence. It's just been a joy to be with. A few months ago, I was in Raleigh. I was in the Center City, and I was in the parking lot of a church. And we were there for memorial service for the people who were killed in Parkland. And we're there for memorial service. We're there to grieve people who have died too soon. We were there to lament a violence that seems to be ever increasing. And so it was a heavy moment, right? But there was also something happening as I was walking through that parking lot. I began to look at people's faces and I began to feel optimistic. It was a counterintuitive feeling, but I saw in all these students, I saw in the signs they were holding and in the t-shirts they were wearing and in all the excitement, I began to sort of feel lighter somehow. And I remember the service began. It was beautiful. There were 17 middle and high school students, and they were standing up in front of us, and each of them spoke the names of one of the people killed, and then a dove was released in their honor, and then they lit a candle for that person, and those 17 kids walked ahead of us all the way to the governor's office, and we put them on the lawn, right? That was powerful, but what was beautiful about this day was that the messages were not given by adults. They were given by middle and high school students. And these students spoke powerfully. They spoke prophetically. And as they talked, the hair on the back of my neck stood up, right? And tears came to my eyes because I realized that hope is not dead. And they're talking. And the one young man gets up in front of everyone and he says, "I'm really happy to be here today." And it sounded strange. And he said, "I'm happy because I woke up today looking for hope." And he scanned the crowd and he said, "And here you are." This is what we do. We mine hope for one another. We remind each other that goodness is still here, that good people still inhabit this place. And this is the job, to take that hope and to take the aspirational stuff and to protect it, to keep it close to our chest, right? Like a candle in the danger of the winds and the weather. And we have to hold that hope tightly. This is what you do. And what I want you to do is look around this room. You probably walked in here feeling isolated and hopeless and alone. You're not alone, and you're not crazy. And if you are crazy, you're in really good company. In the book, A Bigger Table, I talk about being invited to my friend Rod's house, and he lives in Northern California. Beautiful wine country. And I talk about when arriving at this home, which is one of those homes that's so nice, you feel like you have to wear booties, right? Or something, because you know, like plastic all over the furniture. It was gorgeous, and it's overlooking the rolling hills of the wine country. And I talked about how beautiful it all was, but I said that the star of that experience wasn't the house or the view. It was my friend's hospitality, because he made me feel welcome in a place I'd never been to. Well, earlier in the year, Rod lost his home in the wildfires. And I called him that day. And he said, "John, it was crazy." He said, "It was 2 a.m. They woke me up. We had 15 minutes. We saved what we could and we left, and the house was gone. And in the morning, there was nothing but ashes there." But Rod said this phrase, "We saved what we could." I want you to remember this phrase, right? Because you can't change who the president is, but you can save some people who are being damaged right now, right? You can't get every pastor to appreciate the beauty of people who are LGBTQ, but you can get some churches to have an understanding, right? You can't help every teenager who's feeling suicidal. You can't help them all feel seen and heard and loved, but you can hear some of them. Right? You can't change everything in this community, but you can change an awful lot, can't you? So I want you to have the courage and the hope and the strength to go out there and save what you can. But the greatest thing is, see, I came here from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I came here looking for hope, and here you are. So So thank you for your time tonight. I'm grateful for your presence. Thank you. 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 It's been an honor to be in your presence. A couple things. I'm going to stay as long as you need. We've got books and t-shirts. The books are almost gone, they told me. So if you need one, go back there really kind of quickly. We have these here. You can get $5 off a book if you need to order it from us. So just take those if you need it. But you're amazing, Tulsa. Thank you.